by the House Public Information Office. A reminder for our members that all discussion will be through the chair, and if you see recognition, please use the raise hand function. And if you cannot find the raise hand function, please feel free to contact Ms. Jenny Nash or Mr. Joe Lincheski, or seek recognition by unmuting yourself and asking the chair for recognition. With that, Mr. Lincheski, please take the roll.
Members, you may unmute yourself when your name is called. Representative Fu Lee.
Lee, present.
Representative Fu Lee, present. Representative Mary Murphy.
Present.
Representative Mary Murphy, present. Representative Dean Erdahl.
I'm present.
Representative Dean Erdahl, present. Representative Esther Abaje.
Present.
Representative Esther Abaje, present. Representative Kayla Berg.
Present.
Representative Kayla Berg, present. Representative Greg Davids.
Davids, present.
Representative Greg Davids, present. Representative Keith Franke.
Present.
Representative Keith Franke, present. Representative Mike Freiberg.
Present.
Representative Mike Freiberg, present. Representative Rick Hansen.
Rick Hansen, present.
Representative Rick Hansen, present. Representative John Hewitt.
Hewitt, present.
Representative John Hewitt, present. Representative Leon Lilly.
Lilly, present.
Representative Leon Lilly, present. Representative Eric Lucero.
Coffee in hand, ready to serve.
Representative Lucero, present. Representative Rena Moran.
Present.
Representative Rena Moran, present. Representative Nels Pearson.
Pearson, present.
Representative Nels Pearson, present. Representative Donald Raleigh.
Raleigh, present, and happy to be here.
Representative Donald Raleigh, present. Representative Jordan Rasmussen.
Present.
Representative Jordan Rasmussen, present. Representative Liz Ryer.
Present.
Representative Liz Ryer, present. Representative Nolan West.
Here.
Representative Nolan West, present. Representative Jay Zhang.
Present.
Representative Jay Zhang, present. Members, with the conclusion of the roll call, please mute your devices. A quorum is present.
Thank you, members. Thank you, Ms. Lincheski. A quorum is present. Representative Murphy, have you had a chance to look at the minutes for January 21st?
Mr. Chair, I move approval of the minutes for January 21st.
Vice Chair Murphy moves approval of the minutes for January 21st. Any discussion? Hearing none, those in favor say aye.
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 Those opposed say nay. The motion prevails and the minutes for January 21st are approved. Members, today's agenda starts a very serious and important conversation that I believe this committee must have. You all have received a link to the report from the House Select Committee on Racial Justice that's co-chaired by Representative Moran and Representative Richardson, and that Representative Erdahl is a member of. Also, the report is attached in your virtual packets that Ms. Jenny Nash sent out yesterday and on the committee's webpage for members of the public. So before we get started with the presentation today by Dr. Bruce Corey, I want to spend a few minutes covering page 7 and 8 of the Select Committee's report. And Ms. Nash, if you could do the share screen. And so these pages highlight how terminology around racism gets used in different ways and can derail our conversations. I thought it would be very helpful for all of us to briefly read the excerpts from the report to help us define racism and the three critical impacts of the system of racism. So according to the Annie E. Casey Foundation, to eliminate racism, we need to name it, frame it, and explain it. A foundation speaks to the importance of establishing a shared language to present data, describe conditions and outcomes, and identify root causes of inequities to create a platform for coordinated work towards equitable outcomes. According to the American Public Health Association, racism is defined as a system of structuring opportunity and assigning value based on the social interpretation of how one looks, which is what we call race, that unfairly disadvantages some individuals and communities, unfairly advantages other individuals and communities, and saps the strength of the whole society through the waste of human resources. Racism is a system, not an individual character flaw or a personal moral failing. It is a system of power that structures opportunity, education, housing, jobs, justice, and assign values worthy or unworthy, full of potential or full of menace, based on so-called race, the social interpretation of how we look. According to Dr. Kamara Jones with the Kaiser Permanente Institute for Health Policy, the system of racism has three critical impacts. First, racism unfairly disadvantages some individuals and communities. When we think or talk about racism at all in this country, this is what we see. But it is important to understand that every unfair advantage has its reciprocal unfair advantage. The second impact of racism is that it unfairly advantages other individuals and communities. That is the whole notion of unearned white privilege that we hardly ever talk about in this nation. The third and perhaps most profound impact is that racism is sapping the strength of the whole society by wasting human resources. When the brilliance in some of our communities is ignored and we're not investing in the full education of our kids because we don't think there's genius in the barrios or the ghettos or on the reservations, that's sapping the strength of our whole society. In short, the definition of racism is not centered on a narrow interpretation of who's racist and who's not. Rather, the definition is more comprehensively focused on the systemic impact of racism, which has a harmful impact on our entire state and nation. We are all adversely impacted by the system of racism. We all play a role in addressing these adverse impacts. So I encourage all of our members and the public to read the whole report. With that, it is my strong desire that the discussion in both capital investment and equity hearings this week lay a new path forward for our committee to assess and make decisions on capital projects, using this additional lens of the race equity lens. So our first speaker today is Dr. Bruce Corey, who will share his research and discuss the economic cause of racism and the need for equity in capital projects. Members, please raise your hand if you have any questions during the presentation. Please proceed, Dr. Corey.
Good morning, Chair Lee and members of the committee. It's my pleasure to be here today. And I really appreciate the enthusiasm of the committee as I heard the roll call among people. And I want to share with you some thoughts around racial disparities and what we could possibly do about it. Just to provide some context in terms of what I'm going to say, I want to share with you a little bit about who I am. I have a PhD from the University of Notre Dame, and when I was a grad student out there, we had a department that looked at different theoretical perspectives to try to get into what should be the right policy or program to be undertaken. And I brought this framework of this open-minded dialogue to the classroom at Concordia. And I'm a reflective practitioner. I have one leg in academia and the other in the community. And for the past two decades or so have been a community economist. So for example, when COVID hit, I began posting on my blog about COVID economics. And soon when the PPP program was launched by the SBA, I engaged with about 10 businesses, minority businesses, to see if they could access those funds. But they had a tough time, as you all know, and we expected from a program like that. But on one day when the SBA decided to open up its doors just only for small business and small lenders, that was the day. For a few hours, I called up these 10 businesses and they all got into the door that day. So it proved a very important point that if, when you have access, people will take advantage of that opportunity. And so we've been engaging with the Federal Reserve Bank, for instance, on how to change its role from not only being the lender of the last resort, but also being lender of the last community resort. And now in this latest round of the PPP program, we have an alliance of banks and community lenders, and we are helping connect people to these opportunities of the program. So I've come from this reflective practitioner lens, and that's what I want to share with you. Some thoughts as we move forward. calling it the Minnesota solution to racial economic disparities because it's rooted in many of the values and experience of Minnesota. So in this presentation, I would plan to talk about, there are different uses of the term. I liked ALANA because it says what I focus on, African, Latino, Asian, Native American, but a very popular name is BIPOC. And so I'm going to be using that word BIPOC for this committee, and then I'm going to talk about the economic costs of racism, which I've estimated, and then some solutions and how we could think about equity and bonding. So in the last two redistrictings, I had the honor of testifying before the judicial panel on redistricting. And in the last round of redistricting, we actually drew a map from the perspective of the BIPOC communities to see what kind of representation we had. It was very interesting. And so by the time when it came for the opportunity to present testimony to the judicial panel, I showed them a map of BIPOC economic assets across Minnesota and asked and challenged the court to develop a system that would ensure the adequate representation of these economic interests. And so I was very happy to see the results of that drawing of the map, where a lot of these economic interests have, in fact, the judicial panel came up with a better representation than what we had proposed. And so when you look at the data, and I look at BIPOC, ALANA, economic interest, basically in a very simple way as income, total income. I'm not using other assets like housing or education or other kinds of assets. It's a very simple definition of income. So there are 125 legislative districts in Minnesota, which have at least $100 million in representing of these ALANA BIPOC economic interests. Interestingly enough, 85% of the Senate districts and 51% of the House districts have these districts with $100 million in assets that needs representation. And for a complete list, you can see these links on the slides that could go up. I just looked at this committee before me, and you represent $3.8 billion in terms of this economic interest. So the bottom line is that there are enough votes and enough reason for the votes in both the House and the Senate to do things that are right and need attention at this very critical time when the economy, when this community has been hit by three crises, as you've seen over the years, not only COVID with a disparate impact on these communities, but also the civil unrest that then in terms of overt racial discrimination that has happened, that put a tremendous amount of pressure on this economy that it's slowly recovering from that. So you may have heard about the Minnesota paradox. How could you have coexistence of a prosperous state and huge disparities, and what can we do about it? And that's my approach of a solution. I'm not going to get into these slides, but they show patterns of how these discriminatory practices or experiences ultimately result in poor outcomes, whether it's housing, and you have some historic roots in Minnesota. When you look at these redlining maps in key cities around Minnesota, where communities were denied the opportunity to grow wealth in a very systematic way. And so around education or around business, you can have these practices that ultimately have an impact. I particularly like this slide because in my thesis in 1987, I basically illustrated that the emperor has no clothes, how our policies, our economic policies, ultimately through complex channels are reflected in child survival and development outcomes. And so when we look at Minnesota, we find our BIPOC communities spread across the state. And I was pleasantly surprised to see in some of these regions such high percentage of the workforce that are from these communities, and also shocking to see that during COVID, how these communities experienced such acute unemployment rates. So these this data is readily available on DEED's website, and it breaks down by different regions of Minnesota to show the economic presence and contribution, as well as the opportunity of the BIPOC communities all across Minnesota. There have been the reports, and I was honored by Governor Ventura in 2000 to chair this working group on minority business development. For the first time, looked at minority businesses as an asset and documented how to grow those assets. This was in 2000. We went statewide. We had statewide hearings, and we produced this report. It's basically lying on the shelf. Then we have other reports like the Minnesota Equity Blueprint, this Twin Cities Economic Inclusion. All these recommendations are basically being recycled, renewed, and offered, waiting to be acted upon. And such is one possible reason why we can see such huge racial disparities, whether you look at income, with Blacks earning 71 cents on the dollar compared to whites. In education, there's a 21% gap in six-year graduation rates between Blacks and whites, 19% gaps for Native Americans. In the housing area, you have a 53% homeownership gap between Blacks and whites, and over 30% for Native Americans and Latinos, and 25% for Asians. And then very interesting in terms of have this entrepreneurial engine called the business. The typical asset of a BIPOC business is around $165,000 in sales compared to $1.4 million of a typical business in Minnesota. So all of this accumulate, and this accumulation I've estimated to be $287 billion. It's an economic loss to Minnesota. It's an economic loss to the BIPOC communities. And the implication of this loss is that the state loses the opportunity of revenue at least about $2 billion by not tapping into this economic engine of economic growth. So it's costing both ends of the deal. It's costing the Alana BIPOC community deeply, and it's costing the state in more ways than taxes, I'm going to illustrate to you.
Dr. Quarry, before you proceed, we have a question from Representative Pearson. Representative Pearson. Representative Pearson, you're muted right now.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Dr. Quarry, for the information you're providing. I'm curious, you know, the statistics that you're presenting to us seem to be focused solely on race, and that's obviously what we're in the discussion of today. Has there ever been a cross analysis done on this information that not only determines race as a factor, but also the amount of time that populations have been within a jurisdiction like the state of Minnesota? I asked the question because, you know, much of our state was, of course, it was Native American land originally, and following conquests, it was developed and settled by largely predominantly European folks that came through this area from Germany, Sweden, Norway, a lot of other, obviously a lot of other countries as well. But since that time, or at least more recently, we haven't had a lot of European immigrants coming to the United States. We haven't seen, any refugee populations from many of those countries. And our state, you know, has been made up. And actually, just over the weekend, I was working with a family. I'm a realtor down in Rochester, and they're looking at, getting into a new property because they're currently in the restaurant business. And they're looking to expand and get a new place. But, you know, they described to me as Cambodian immigrants that they came to this country with nothing. And they look at the opportunities that they have here as being remarkable in the state of Minnesota. So I guess I kind of asked the question because we analyze this stuff so specifically. I just wonder if that question is ever analyzed within a dynamic of how long someone has been in the state of Minnesota. Again, I see many communities thriving locally here and many individuals thriving. So just curious if there's additional information there.
Dr. Corey.
Chair Lee and Representative Pearson, thanks for that question. It is a very important question to think about, and you're basically asking for a longitudinal kind of study to see what factors play a role in success. Two responses to that. In Minnesota, Dr. Sam Myers at the Humphrey Institute has done some economic analysis, basically trying to look at multitude of factors in a very sophisticated econometric analysis to figure out what role does race play. And after he puts in all possible factors to explain differences in outcomes, he still couldn't explain the differences. Now, there was still some unexplained component that could not be explained that could be attributed towards what we would call racial systemic kinds of things. So the kind of longitudinal studies that you have would require a tremendous amount of resources, and the resources that is the federal government. So the federal government looked at what is, for instance, the longitudinal impact of immigrants. And they did some high-powered studies to come up to it in terms of this cost-benefit analysis. And they came up to that analysis that there's a net benefit in immigration. So individual longitudinal studies, I'm not aware, but looking at communities as a group, whether you look at people of Mexican origin, for instance, who have been in this state for many years, decades, and not much progress in their experience, their economic experience, because again, historical records that are documented in the Minnesota History Center will show that a lot of these workers were denied economic opportunities by nature of their occupation, and some of them had to leave in the winter, for instance, and live in St. Paul and survive during that time and then go back to the field. So it's a good question that would take a lot of resources, but I would think, based on what I'm seeing, that we still would have this presence of outcomes, negative outcomes, that is largely unexplained by these models that are not as sophisticated as we want them to be. I hope that answers your questions.
Representative Pearson, follow up.
No follow-up. I guess I appreciate the acknowledgement that there is, you know, multiple factors that are playing into an effect. You know, again, many of these statistics are very alarming, and you know, one can't argue that we can do better. And yet, in one way, I want to make sure that we're kind of pushing down or creating a negative stigma on the positive things that we do in having immigrants come to our state, the positive influence and outcomes that we see throughout our state, in our culture, and in the vibrancy of our communities. But at the end of the day, looking at some of these numbers, you know, you want to make sure that we're addressing resources in a positive manner. And, again, any dollar I feel like in this committee that's put towards the U of M or the state college system, you know, all of those resources, we put a blindfold on and make sure that those resources are going to those schools, and the schools are doing a great job, I think, of of making sure that we're incorporating all communities and very aggressively affecting that in those policies. So I appreciate the full rundown and the ultimately the acknowledgement of the dynamics that are at play here.
Representative Raleigh.
Thank you, Chair Lee. Dr. Corey, in the previous slide, you'd said that there's $287 billion in cost of racial disparities and a $2 billion tax loss. In this slide, you've got tax payments of $5 billion. And my question is, are you postulating that fixing these disparities will bring in $287 billion in new revenue with new either $2 billion or $5 billion, depending on which slide we're on, tax payments? Or is this a transfer of these revenues from one community to a different community? Thank you, Chair.
Dr. Corey.
Chair Lee and Representative Raleigh, thanks for the question. First, I'd like to provide a context about numbers, right? The numbers are not written in stone. They are estimates of potential impact. And what I'm communicating with these numbers, that it's not zero, and it's not one, and it's not a million, it's in the billions. So we may debate about whether it is 200 billion or 20 billion or what, but there is a deep economic impact, and to the best of my ability and the tools that I have, I'm offering an estimate for discussion, for thought, and for engagement. I also want to point that as I go out with this presentation, that the data and the analysis is not a zero-sum game, that someone wins and someone loses, someone's taken and someone receives. It's more integrative, and as you can see in some of the examples I'll show you, that as we engage in a very active strategy, the potential of lifting up all of Minnesota is really there, and there is evidence to show that it can lift everybody up.
Representative Raleigh.
Yes, thank you, Dr. Corey. More specifically to my question, and I'll agree with you that it's going to be greater than a dollar and less than a trillion, but there's some number greater than zero that you're talking about, and you utilize the word cost. And again, my question I think that I want to get to is, are you stating that there will be an estimated $287 billion cost that will then be relieved, meaning new dollars into Minnesota? Or is this a shift of dollars from one community to a different community? Because if it's an estimated $287 billion in new business and in new prosperity, I'd love to hear how that's done. Thank you.
Dr. Corey.
Chair Lee and Representative Raleigh, thanks for the question. If I can explain the slide, it might help to understand how $287 billion comes about, right? And so what I'm showing here is that if you look at the gap in income between the BIPOC communities and white income, you have and if all communities went through strategy, through policies, through a multiple comprehensive approach, incomes rose to be on par. That would be that gap that could be covered. The same way, if you look at the lifetime of earnings of people, depending upon their educational levels, and if all of the BIPOC communities' educational levels were on par, say, with the white educational levels, which interestingly enough is still low, there would be a gain to the society of about $174 billion. And if all businesses that are these small businesses with $165,000 in revenue compared to $1.4 million on average, if they were to grow in size to be on par with that, the average business, that would generate $67 billion in new wealth. Similarly with home ownership. So what I'm saying is that if you estimate the gap, and this is a gap that could be estimated to be around $287 billion. And that is what I'm proposing is that cost of racial disparities, the economic gap, and the opportunity that arises from filling this gap will benefit not only these communities, but everybody else.
Follow up, Representative Raleigh.
Thank you, Chair. Again, my question was, and thank you for these lessons in economics, because I'm trying very hard to understand them. It sounds like what you're saying is this would be a shift from one community to a different community, but not, and I don't want to put words in your mouth. It doesn't sound like this would raise an additional $287 billion into Minnesota. Would you state that this would be a shift of these funds within the economic structure of our current system?
Mr. Chair, Representative Raleigh, another way of looking at this number is that because of these structures of systemic racism in the state that intervened in different wealth-building activities of the state, these communities are not at par at what other community, the white community or the state average is at. And so there is a loss to the BIPOC communities of that amount of wealth. That's one of the messages of the data.
All right, last follow-up, Representative Raleigh.
Thank you, Chair. This seems to be a very complicated issue. And Chair, I really appreciate the opportunity for me to get up to speed on this. I really do. I would like to study more on what the meaning of the word cost is in this context, and then the $22 billion in loss, because I've still not heard that this is going to be either new revenue that's coming in or whether or not it's a shift in revenue from one organization or one structure to another. And I'm trying to be very careful about the words that I'm using as far as how this money is shifting. So, Chair, I think I'll leave it at that. I obviously need to learn more about this. And I'm very curious about the words cost and loss in the context of this particular economic structure. So thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you, Representative Raleigh. And I encourage you to connect with Dr. Corey after this too, and really have this more in-depth conversation. Next up, we have Representative Hansen, and then Representative Freiberg, Ryer, and then Morant. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It seems that the issue here for capital investment is that over decades, we have invested critical infrastructure based on power, which the power resides in the systemic racism. So there is years and years and years of investment that occur where until recently, there wasn't actual BIPOC representation in communities. And so it's the needs are hidden or maybe underrepresented. So when we are investing in things, and I'm a Keynesian, I believe in priming the pump for economic activity, that capital investment is actually public works. So for public works, if we are not investing in basic infrastructure in communities that are BIPOC or have significant BIPOC participation, then they are missing out on the economic activity that is being generated when we are investing significant infrastructure in other areas around Minnesota. Is that part of it? It seems that that's the issue here. And the issue for us going forward is that we've had underinvestment based on tradition and power that has resulted in less investment, public works in communities of color or communities that are underrepresented, that has an impact on lessening their economic activity that features down into every person in those areas.
Dr. Corey.
Chair Lee and Representative Hansen, thank you for that question. It was an insight that when we proposed the redistricting map to the judicial panel on redistricting, when we drew maps respecting every principle of redistricting, we could see very clearly how when lines were drawn, power was shifted away from the BIPOC communities to other communities. So there was a loss in power, and the loss in power meant a loss in voice. And you're right, those loss in voice then decides who's at the table and who's not at the table. So there are historical roots that are documented in these redlining maps that shows how systematic decisions resulted in these impacts on communities.
Follow up, Representative Hansen.
But Mr. Chair, I think this shapes our activity for the future. When we're looking at critical investments, we need to make sure that we are not only recognizing where those investments are needed, but trying to build up those areas that may have suffered for lack of investment in the past.
Thank you, Representative Hansen. Next up, we have Representative Freiberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm glad you put that redlining map back up there briefly. My question relates to that. A couple of years ago, we passed a law that allows people the opportunity to denounce racially restrictive covenants from their properties. A lot of houses in the district I represent still have language on their property records that's not— it's not just structural racism, it's explicit racism. I've just pulled up an example one here that says no persons of any race other than the Caucasian race shall use or occupy any building or any lot, except that this covenant shall not prevent co-occupancy by domestic servants of a different race domiciled with an owner or tenant. So the city of Golden Valley has actually set up this Just Deeds project that that has teams of volunteer attorneys to follow this process that we passed a couple of years ago to denounce these racially restrictive covenants. I've actually helped with a couple properties myself on as part of that project. You know, I'm just wondering if there's any way— you know, I know these restrictive covenants haven't been enforceable for a few decades, but I'm just wondering, Dr. Corey, if activities like this have the— if there's any way to quantify the effect of denouncing racially restrictive covenants.
Dr. Corey.
Chair Lee and Representative Freiberg, thanks for bringing to light an important point about historical roots of current asset building and the denial of the opportunities to build wealth, whether it was through the GI Bill or through racial covenants. Your question whether whether there was any attempts right now to change these covenants or to bring rectify some of these impacts. I believe there are groups that are working to first identify and document the historical records, and then to look back and say what can we do to remedy or rectify this historic injustice.
Representative Freiberg.
That's fine, thank you.
Next up, we have Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Dr. Corey. I have a question. I think I want to make sure that I'm interpreting that same slide, the $287 billion cost, that one, appropriately. As I look at it, I don't see a takeaway for some for a gain for others. I see an impact statement, and I look at, for example, $22 billion loss in income. And when I think about closing the income gap, I don't see a loss of income to the majority community. I see a bringing together of incomes rising. So it's not one has to go up, it's not zero sum. So I don't see a shift there. And I'm wondering if if I'm on track with how I'm thinking about it. And then with, for example, the $67 billion in business revenue, the question I suppose that could come to mind is, why is it 165,000 versus 1.2, if I'm remembering the numbers properly? Well, if you look at the slide that you had in business discrimination that we didn't go over in detail, I just want to point out that we are looking at bank policies, funding policies, the ability to get public contracts, structural inequities there where, again, it's not taking away from anyone else. It's not shifting. It's creating a level playing field, and then, you know, may the better company win when they all have the opportunity. Am I on track with the message you're sending, and what? How would you comment on that?
Dr. Corey?
Chair Lee and Representative Rayo, thanks for that question. You're right, on track in terms of it's documenting the loss in revenue and the reasons for the loss, like you were you're sharing about your analysis of the business channel of how that the access to opportunity. I shared initially about the PPP program, but these businesses couldn't get into the door, the formal door for lending. It was only in that window when there was an access afforded to them, and they had the help from nonprofits to help them get their papers together, that they've gotten to the door. So it requires that kind of attention. And as I go through the slides, you'll find many of the questions that you've asked have been kind of answered about how these connections are between leveraging the growth of this potential that these communities offer, but also to show that it's a win-win situation. It's not a zero-sum game, because I've got some analysis to show that.
Representative Ryer.
No, thank you for that, and I look forward to the opportunity to have policy that helps support these goals. Thank you.
Representative Moran, and then Representative Erdog. Representative Moran.
Thank you, Chair Lee, and good morning, everyone. And so kind of like, you know, I think, you know, as we look at this page here that's in front of us about a $280 billion cost of racial disparities in Minnesota, and when I look at the loss in income, you know, we're looking at, you know, in the wage gap. Historically in the history in Minnesota, in this country, that you had a slide here to talk about the inequities of African Americans are making only 71 cents to the dollar, and Native Americans 68% to the dollar, and Latinos 70% to the dollar. And so what you're seeing here in the income ratio gap on this slide here is that the inequities that these communities of color are starting off at a disadvantage. And this is in disregard to the fact that they may have a college education, they may have, you know, the experience, the expertise, but they still are starting off in their wages at a disadvantage compared to, example, a white man who may be getting a dollar for his work. A black is getting 71 cents. And that causes the loss in wage gap, whatever that dollar amount you saw in that other slide. That's the loss, right? And when we are making, as you know, when a person is making more money, we begin to spend and we pay taxes on the dollars, on that income. So there's a loss there in income. There's a loss. And here, the example he says is at least, you know, what you see in front of you. And that goes the same thing when you look at home ownership. For example, in my community, the Rondo community, with the construction of I-94 going through the Black community. And we know historically in Minnesota, in our country, that wealth is gained through home ownership. And those small businesses, and those businesses that was in that community, that was all taken away with the construction of I-94, right? So you had home ownership loss, that transfer of wealth. We're still being impacted by that loss even today here in St. Paul because of that loss. Those businesses, that wealth that was lost has an impact. And so there is a cost associated with that loss. And the same thing goes for businesses. When we are not able, when we as a state have systems in place that do not invest in minority businesses in the way that we do in other businesses, there's a loss associated with that for businesses of color to be, you know, not only do a business impact that business owner, but they're hiring people from the community. They are training people from the community. They are investing in people like those moms and pop businesses is the foundation of our community. And we as a state do not invest in that. There's a loss associated with that. There's a cost to that. And so what I see before us is because of the inequities, because of systemic racism here in the state of Minnesota, there's a $287 billion cost that is associated with the loss that is happening through home ownership, through lack of being able to pay a fisher and to increase the tax base, you know, the revenue base. So, Representative, I hope that this example is helpful. But I would also really like to suggest that you go back and you, if you have not, read again maybe the Select Committee on Racial Justice, because it really does help us get grounded in not just the moment that we're in right now, but a history of what has gotten us to right here in this moment. And we as legislators, because what we know is that systemic racism is about policies and laws that created practices. It's that those lawmakers who put those barriers in place for communities of color to have the full potentials of the American dream has consequences today for us. So it's important for us as state legislators to be able to see the role that we need to play to make sure that we are creating fair and equitable investments into all communities, into minority communities, because history tells us that that type of investment or insight has not been at the forefront. And because of that disinvestment, because of that lack of, because of that structural racism, through laws and policies that have been in place, here we are today. And so as lawmakers, we have an opportunity here to begin to look at our work to look at our work and say, how do we create a process today that is more fair and equitable, that we are investing in these communities that we historically have not invested in, right? And now, when we don't do that, there's a loss associated to that, and there's a cost to our state. And we're just missing out in a huge amount of revenue that could become, you know, that could be and should be a part of the revenue that helps our state move forward in a bigger and greater way. That is not there because of all these lost earnings that we see before us. So, Doctor, that's how I see it. Dr. Corey, you know, in your research, is these some of the gaps that, you know, your findings have come up with, is this some of the findings that you have saw over the history of how we invest or maybe disinvest in minorities communities in Minnesota?
So Dr. Corey, and then after that, we'll go to Representative Erdog for his questions, and then we can proceed with the presentation. Dr. Corey to Representative Moran's question.
Chair Lee, Representative Moran, thank you for the question. I agree with you in your analysis that this is an attempt to quantify the deep economic loss experience with this historic experience with systemic racism in Minnesota. In itself, it is a very deeply impacted experience with these communities, but the responsibility and the leadership right now in this day and this time is for this body to take the leadership and look forward and with the right set of investments in the right areas and with the right tools, we can generate not only economic wealth for the minority communities, but this wealth creation is going to benefit all Minnesotans because of this interdependent nature of our economy. We spend a dollar on construction, and that construction ultimately ends up in the neighborhood restaurant or the gas station or the utility company. And these are owned not necessarily by people from the minority communities. These are owned by all Minnesotans. So there is a very strong strategy by focusing on the ones that are hurt most that will lift everybody else up.
Thank you, Dr. Corey. Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Chair Lee. Dr. Corey and committee members, I think this is a very good discussion that we're having, but I think sometimes we're getting a little far afoot here as to things that are not within the purview of the Capital Investment Committee. And I just want to focus, and maybe Dr. Corey, you were starting to do this, but to remind you and others that we deal with infrastructure and capital investment. We deal in public buildings. We deal in roads and bridges. We deal in projects that have a regional significance, housing, education, our education buildings. These are the types of things that we do. Now, we did earmark cash in our last bonding bill that
Representative Erdahl, I think we lost you. Mm-hmm. Representative Erdahl, are you still on? So why don't we proceed, Dr. Corey, and then once we establish a connection with Representative Erdahl, we will recognize him again. Please proceed, Dr. Corey.
Thank you. So focusing on what can be done to leverage these assets, BIPOC assets, to build the Minnesota economy. And I like the way that racial inclusion strategy has been framed by Speaker Hortman and Chair Moran yesterday about the butter and the batter, how it could be an integrative strategy that will create something that will work for everybody. And I'd like to use an African-American phrase of how we could lift as we climb in terms of the strategies that we may target. One of the first ways to start is to change our perceptions of how we view the Alana minority communities. Looking at them as assets, a $1.4 trillion asset to the Minnesota economy, $1.4 trillion is bigger than the GDP of Mexico. And so a common strategy on race, or if you were to deny someone's value, that's the best way you could exploit and dominate them. And so we need to acknowledge and affirm the strong, important contribution that the minority communities are making to the Minnesota economy. And this goes in different ways, from income that's fueling expenditures to businesses that are employing 63,000 plus Minnesotans with 1.5 billion in payroll, to these 500,000 workers in all sectors of Minnesota, representing about a $1.4 trillion in lifetime earnings, to the youth in our schools and universities. For about 500,000 of them that if all of them have achieved a bachelor's degree, it would be a $1.5 trillion in lifetime earnings, generating $3 billion in taxes and bringing cultural and global assets to the table. And so as Representative Erdahl was, what I was getting from his statement is that this committee builds on infrastructure. And I want to talk about the economic asset building infrastructure that is needed in every community in these diverse communities that can help them grow wealth. And these could be things like land trust or business incubators and maker spaces and equity funds that could generate wealth and help people create wealth in their communities. The Select Committee on Racial Justice, one of their recommendations was that there are some tools within the state system that does not cost any money but requires political will and leadership, and that is enforcing Section 16C and allocating 15% of all public contracts to BIPOC businesses, including the workforce goals of 32%, and streamlining the processes so it makes these utilization of these businesses possible, and enforcing Section 3 HUD rules that are not being viewed at all, but is a powerful engine of economic growth in public housing and low-income neighborhoods. So when I started looking at this data in 2000 to today, we can see it's not been very well used, this strategy of public spending to grow Minnesota's businesses. It's not working for the BIPOC communities. If you add this total spend, this number of less than around 2% has not changed for the last 20 years that I've seen this study. So there is a vast underutilization of businesses and less under the opportunity to build and leverage public spending in a very comprehensive way that does not look at it as a one-off kind of investment, but makes sure that there are businesses grow as they participate in these different public projects and become mature businesses like the rest of businesses. So here's an example of how we could look at how this could be a win-win situation for all in Minnesota. I use an economic model called IMPLAN that generates estimates, best estimates of what would happen with investment decision. So when I look at all the different sectors of Minnesota's economy and said, what would happen if these industries' output would increase by 10% because we did such a good job in encouraging minority businesses to grow from small percentages in these sectors to at least about 10% of sales. And when I generate this into the model, it says if this was done, you could expect about $111 billion of income to increase, output to increase in Minnesota, generating about 500,000 jobs for Minnesotans at large and about another $13 billion in federal, state, and local taxes. And the beauty about this model, it shows that when you focus on one sector, it has interdependence into other sectors, from manufacturing to real estate to accommodation to food services. And so there is a way in which strategic investments can build not only the minority communities, but can build the communities around them. For example,
Dr. Corey, I'm sorry to cut you off. Representative Erdahl is back on it. So Representative Erdahl, please proceed with your question. And you may find better internet connection if you turn off your video. And so after your question, Dr. Corey, just know that you have about 10 minutes left of your presentation to cover the relevant point that you want to make. Representative Erdahl.
Okay, thank you, Chair Lee. I'm sorry about that. This has worked very well from the hotel, but I lost you and I had trouble getting you back. I believe I left you saying that in our last bonding bill, we did do earmarks for BIPOC communities specifically, I think about 10, 12 of them. But again, trying to focus a little bit here, and maybe Dr. Corey, you've touched on this, but you know, specifically, what type of projects do you think that the Capital Investment Committee should invest in, keeping in mind, you know, it's infrastructure, public buildings, and those types of things is what we do.
Dr. Corey.
Chelly, Representative Erdahl, thank you for your question. I think, yes, There could be three kinds of projects that could be very effective in terms of investments. One would be projects that are located in the heart of these diverse communities, especially low-income communities, because it has the multiplier effects like you see in these sectors of not only helping employment in that particular project, but projects that connect and sectors that connect with them. There could be an emphasis on projects that can demonstrate that they are actively engaging the local community around them in the production and the construction and what is being used for that, because that ultimately is what's needed to have. How can the neighborhood and the city and the communities around them grow as these projects grow? And so those are some angles, and this example that's next on my slide will offer some more insight on that.
Representative Erdahl.
Okay, thank you.
Please proceed, Dr. Corey.
Yeah, Lee. And so the project that was funded by the legislature, the Hmong America Farmers Association in Dakota County, I just did a simulation to see what could a possible impact could it have on Dakota County and the counties around him, because not only would be buying this real estate, but also there's going to be generating about $1 million in output from these farms. And so this has an impact that goes across the region, across these different sectors, and also increases, has a potential to increase jobs as well as state and local taxes, an estimated 21 jobs. But there's a bigger story to this, because the choice of this project, as Representative Erdahl said, choosing the Hmong American Farmers Association was tied to a deeper strategy of economic development around the next generation of farmers in Minnesota. And if you look at statistics on agriculture, you'll see that these Hmong, Latino, African, Native American farmers, they're adding a lot of wealth in their communities and also in some very unique product ways. And so this project was going to help 100 Hmong farmers grow in terms of their business, but there are about 300 Hmong farmers estimated in the state that also could somehow be connected to this project and increase their base. So as we're growing the farming, the next generation of farmers in Minnesota, we are also investing in this unique particular project. Similarly, in the Red Lake Nation, there was a project for $5.5 million, and I looked at what would be the impact of this project in Beltrami County by building here and the kinds of interconnectedness that happens with a project like this, including investment from the Red Lake Nation. This project would generate about $14 million in output. It would support at least 150 jobs with ripple effects right throughout the region, and could result in an estimated $2.1 million in federal, state, and local taxes. So choosing a project in the Red Lake Nation was very strategic, because it was going to help spur up economic development, meet a human need of the community, and then cause long-term economic growth for the region as a whole. The state, as Representative Erdahl said, in terms of this economic development infrastructure, has a lot of tools that can use to leverage private funding, whether the creation of TIF districts, or loan guarantees, or BIPOC funds. I want to talk a little bit about loan guarantees as a very powerful instrument that could complement these projects. I was talking to the president of Drake Bank just 2 days ago, and he said, you know, why the PPP program was so effective is because Deed offered this loan guarantee to banks that allowed them now to be more aggressive as they moved out and did outreach to small businesses. And so it's a strategy that can have the potential to leverage a huge amount of economic development through the sharing of risk. Yesterday, I was in part of a conversation where in the African-American community, in a project that was funded by this legislature through the North Commons. And this person from outside Minnesota said, hey, we are ready to bring in capital to Minnesota, But we want to see what are you providing? What's the state going to do? What's the local banks going to do? What is the community going to do? Because we want, it's going to take a village to do what we need to do, and we need to do it together. So the power and the potential of the state to leverage private dollars currently in this time, when millions of dollars are being set aside by corporations, by foundations for economic development, this committee and this state could, the right set of policies, be leverage this huge amount of capital that can be accessed by providing certain options. And so an example of how multiple sectors can get involved in the development of the project, and the state through this community committee and through other sectors could leverage public-private partnerships to create wealth and bring in these players into the system. So investments and political leadership can help close the racial disparity gap, and doing so will not only expand output, employment, and tax base, but benefit all Minnesotans. And so I'm going to stop here. There are some other ideas out here by concluding that this is a very important time of opportunity, and this committee can play a very critical role by helping to partner with communities, especially the ones that have been so deeply impacted by a history of racial discrimination, by investing in projects, physical infrastructure projects, but also using the power of the state through loan guarantees and tools like TIF to encourage large-scale developments, large-scale capital infrastructure for businesses to develop, so that, and that in turn is going to have a great and positive impact for the state as a whole, because you're going to be bringing in new investment that the state will not necessarily see. As the example I explained about yesterday, where the gentleman said, I'm willing to bring in equity, otherwise I'm looking in other states too, but we want to see what you can do here in Minnesota. So thank you for this opportunity, and I look forward to engaging with you individually or as a committee, and to talk through some of the questions that have been raised here, which are important ones. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Corey. And so we have about 3 more minutes for this presentation. Next up, we have Representative Davids with a question.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Dr. Corey. Some of the things I think we're trying to get to here are already in current law. It looks to me like some of these things for minority businesses, and it's already there. I do get a bit concerned about the government picking winners and losers. I've always been a believer in everyone has equal opportunity, but we can't guarantee results. And I want to make sure we kind of don't go down that road. At what point do we have reverse discrimination where there's a contractor out there owned by, let's say, a white woman, and because she's not African-American or Asian, she has a better bid, better quality. In this case, just, you know, she should get the bid, but she doesn't because she's white. Does that constitute reverse discrimination? And how do we see, I'm always looking for balance. I think we have to have fairness, even though my mother, God rest her soul, never said life would be fair. And are we trying to make up for past actions, or are we trying to get a level playing field and move it forward? Dr. Corey.
Dr. Corey.
Chair Lee, Representative Gregory, thank you for the question. I'm glad you understand the cost of actions, because the statistics I just showed for the last 20 years, that the state had the option, had the leadership, had the data that came every year on utilization of minority businesses, but still it hasn't crossed the 2% utilization rates. So there were businesses that were willing and able and could do the job, and these were documented in disparity studies, but still did not get the job. And that was the big cost that these businesses faced. And so there is a whole lot of historical neglect that also needs to be integrated into decision-making as we move forward.
Follow-up, Representative Davids?
Yes, thank you so much, Mr. Chairman, Dr. Corey. My concern is, you know, I want fairness for everyone. But if we go too far, like I'm kind of feeling like some folks want to do, at what point do we draw the line and say, hey, this is reverse racism. Now we're discriminating against this group. And again, I think a lot of this, you know, we certainly want to take race into consideration in bonding, but I think there's other committees where things would have to be moved forward. And many things the bonding committee has funded over the years are for everyone. They're for everyone. So I don't know if this is really the committee. I think it's good we had this presentation today, but we need to look at fairness amongst all people and not get into a situation where we're discriminating against others and might not even know it.
Thank you, Representative David. And so Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker, Mr. Chair, the promotion there. I appreciate this conversation. It definitely is one that helps to put some of the unfortunate warts that are truthful in our history. And that's incredibly unfortunate. One of the things that I was struck by with the presentation, though, let me put my phone on silent. One of the things that I was struck in the presentation, though, is the focus on externalities. Everything I've heard were forces that are apparently external to people, and that each of us are just leaves blowing in the wind, you know, uncontrolled by forces that are beyond our capacity to have influence over. And I categorically reject that. I also take incredible exception to the continued reference of groups of people as some homogenous group that don't have differences. I instead look at people as individuals. As a minority myself, I'm an individual married to an individual minority with our own passions, our own decisions. And in regards to the external forces here, I'll just ask the question rhetorically rather than asking the presenter himself, but to what degree do life choices impact our outcomes as individuals, as families, as communities, such as the decision to have children before marriage? Does that have an economic impact on people's lifetime earnings, such as the decision to place a priority on education? Because I know that there are families that choose not to place an emphasis or priority on education versus those that do. My wife being Indian, I can tell you that generally speaking, the Indian community places a high value, high priority on academic achievement. It is also, I think, when we look at some of these metrics and we point to home ownership, right? The generally speaking, the Indian community, the Asian Indian community has a tendency to be a higher propensity renters rather than homeowners. And those are, it's not as a product of some external force, it's an individual lifestyle choice. And so, Mr. Chair and members, I just want to draw to our attention that we're not just products that require some Keynesian economic government engineered choices that are going to better us. That's not how it works. The larger influence, the larger factor for each of us as individuals is to start with the mindset that we are not a victim and we are going to work hard. We're going to use the opportunities available to us and make those individual choices, lifestyle, and delayed gratification sacrifices in order to propel ourselves upward. That is the greater influence in the outcome of our lives and our happiness. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Lucero. And so as chair, I will take the last comment here and so that we can move on to the three other projects. I know that we have three members with their hands up, but we have entertained your questions already. And so I just want to say that, you know, for us, we really should consider you know, these investments that we're making through a race equity lens and really look at the impact that we're seeing. And I can say that, you know, yesterday I had a conversation with the mayor of Blaine, you know, former Representative Tim Sanders. And really he was able to emphasize the investment if we were to be able to make into the city of Blaine, how that's going to impact the communities of color in his district and being able to, navigate, their city and getting connected to some of the commercial opportunities that they have in place in their district. And so we should not be discounting the work that we have in front of us and the impact that we can make. And Dr. Corey, thank you for, running the models on the impact that our investment are going to make, specifically focusing on, the Hmong American Farmers Association and from the community center in Red Lake, and the not only the impact that they're going to make to their individual communities, that the population that they're serving, but, the immediate geographic city or location that they're located in. And so I really want to start thinking about those impact that we're going to make. And so we're going to hear from these three projects that were included in the October bonding bill. And then on Thursday, we will actually hear from different community members and really learn about what does equity and bonding look like. And so we could dig a little bit deeper into this conversation on Thursday too. And with that, I would like to first have Dr. Anthony Stately from the Native American Community Clinic to present their project. Dr. Stately.
Good morning, Representative Lee and the rest of the committee. I appreciate the opportunity to talk with you this morning. Thank you, Dr. Corey, for that very insightful and dense presentation. I think it was really helpful actually for me as well. So I appreciate the opportunity to be part of that, to be able to listen in on the presentation. So the Native American Community Clinic was successful in working with the legislature and a number of committees, including yours, to be included in a bonding bill, the equity bill last year, which provided us with $3.8 million towards the purchase of our building that we currently operate in. And what we're doing with that that money is we're going to purchase the building that we've been in leasing for the last 17 years. And what that will allow us to do is also double our footprint in size physically. So we're going to get the other half of the building that we currently don't own or rent. And we'll be able to double the size of our clinic to 22,000 square feet. We're also moving into phase two because of that. And we will be working with a number of folks to develop our capital campaign that will actually bring in private sector money and philanthropy to help us renovate and remodel and expand our clinical footprint in South Minneapolis. The Native American Community Clinic is right on Franklin Avenue in the heart of the American Indian Cultural Corridor. And as Dr. Corey was talking about the impact of inequity from an economic lens, I of course have the lens of healthcare. In the state of Minnesota, and specifically in South Minneapolis, which is one of the densest urban American Indian populations in the United States. There are other populations throughout the United States that have more Native Americans in their cities, but we have the densest population, meaning the majority of them live in a specific area of South Minneapolis in the urban area. That's the community that Native American Community Clinic serves. We look at the health and well-being of Native people across the state, but specifically in South Minneapolis. We have some of the highest health disparities in the state that have been in place and durable and long-lasting for decades. We have the worst healthcare the worst health outcomes in uncontrolled diabetes, obesity, hypertension, asthma. Of course, we have the highest overdose rates and opiate overdoses, a number of other mental health and substance use related inequities. And those things are the things that NAC works with, Native American Community Clinic. We are a primary healthcare center, an FQHC that focuses a lot of our work on prevention and primary care services in the medical, dental, and substance use and mental health services. And over the last 4 years under my leadership, NAC has significantly grown in size, both in terms of the services it delivers, but also in the size of the staff that we have. When I stepped into the clinic's leadership role 4 years ago, 4 years ago, we had 42 staff. Today we have 96 staff. Significantly expanded our behavioral health footprint such that we had to actually lease space outside of the building because we couldn't no longer provide those services within the building. So this capital expansion project is going to allow us to renovate and remodel the clinic and modernize the clinic. It has not been modernized in, you know, the 18 years that we've had it. And we will be able to bring services all back in our integrated model back into one setting and allow us to sort of deliver care in an expanded model. It will allow us also to increase the number of jobs. We're looking at about 15 to 20 full-time medical delivery jobs and a significant increase in revenue generation.
Thank you, Dr. Stalia. We have to move on to the next presentation. We have Jensen Hain from the Hmong American Farmers Association.
Thank you, Chairman Lee. Chair Lee here. I had prepared a presentation here that I'd like to share and quickly just go through, if any of you guys can see that. So good morning, Chair Lee and members of the committee, and thank you for allowing me the opportunity to join you this morning here. My name is Jansen Hain, and I am a co-founder and also the executive director with the Hmong American Farmer Association here. I want to thank all of you for believing in community investments and recognizing the equity bond to increase opportunity for I also want to thank Chairman Lee and members of the community for supporting our bill here and allocating and appropriating $2 million to the Hmong American Farmers Association. This is monumental and truly a pivotal point in Minnesota history. Once the land purchase is completed, the farm will be the only farmland in the United States owned by a Hmong-led nonprofit for Hmong and immigrant farmers here. So in this presentation, I wanted to provide you with a little background about HAFA, also the Hmong American Farm Association, and why equitable access and capital projects is essential in growing our community wealth here. Right? So the Hmong American Farm Association is a community-based organization that works with over 100 Hmong farmers to support and uplift Hmong farming families in Minnesota. Farmers are at the forefront of the local Twin Cities food economy, 50% of all the farmers in the metropolitan area farmers market here. But typical Hmong farmers have been commercially farming for over 25 years and grow over 60 different types of vegetables on a 10-acre parcel or less. But unfortunately, despite their experience, Hmong farmers face numerous obstacles to farming, including lack of access to land tenures, capital, alternative markets, farmers market, trainings, and research. And not to mention the structural racism in traditional agricultural institutions and rural communities here. In fact, Hmong farmers have shared a story that their white landowner would lease land to Hmong farmers in Dakota County anywhere from $300 to $500 an acre, which is 2 to 3 times more than what they would lease to their white neighbors. Or that Hmong farmers also agreed to conditions set by the white landowners that would allow the owner and also their families to harvest the produce that Hmong farmers grew. All of these, which kind of helped and supported and which regulated Hmong farmers to like more second class here. And as a result of that, they had Hmong farmers making on average about $5,000 an acre compared to white farmers making about $8,000. And that in overall here, that the average income of Hmong farming families is about $32,000, you know, compared to the median incomes of Minnesota farmers, which is about $42,000 here. Right. So as a result of this, you know, it was necessary for the inception of the Hmong American Farmer Association to support and uplift Hmong farmers, and that equitable access is critical to advance economic prosperity, which is rooted in our theory of change here. Right? And in our theory of change, HAFA was created to foster equity in the food and farming industry and to dramatically change the landscape for Minnesota Hmong farmers. That in our theory of change is rooted in a whole food model, which ensures that all aspects of food and farming industry, land, market, capital, trainings, and research must be simultaneously and freely accessible to immigrant farmers to truly build intergenerational and community wealth. We also believe that good intention alone will never get our farmers to purity, and that a just and equitable food and farming system demand a shift in power. And that we believe that action will lead to our intended outcome because of three main reasons. that we use a community organizing tactic that are fundamentally about people coming to their own political consciousness, and that we work with whole families and cohort our farmers because system change requires organized people, and that we bring people together. Because,
thank you, Mr. Hing. We have to move on now because of the time limit. Next on up, we have Cherry Goodwin, the executive director of the Red Lake Nation Family and Child Services.
So bonjour, good morning, everybody. My name's Cherry Goodwin. I oversee the Family and Children Services. We have a new name, which means Obimindwa Gadanawe Mani Dug, which basically means uplifting our relatives. And today, it's a good day to be listening to everybody talk about the racial injustices that some of our people feel. I'm really honored to be here, and I want to thank each and every one of you for supporting us on this endeavor. It's a much-needed building. Of course, it's going to have intergenerational cultural services, which means child welfare, adult services, elder services, behavioral health, et cetera, et cetera. I'm really excited. We want to be the shining star of the North. And I'm really glad that Dr. Corey then did an analyzation of the money that we'll be putting into the building and the social economics it'll have within the community. Of course, you know, when we went knocking on the legislator door, it was like we needed like 10 million. Then we downsized to 8 million. And we end up with 5.575. So us, Red Lake Nation, is committed to coming up with a difference. We do need an $8.25 million building, right? We want to give hope in the community. So to me, it's just really exciting because as we know, Minnesota has some of the worst disparity rates for Native Americans and people of color. And I'm here to say that by giving hope, by hiring our people, by utilizing 32% of the workforce into this construction project, that's hope. And I'm really glad Dr. Corey brought that up because I want to see our Native people working hand in hand with the contractors that we bring from the surrounding area, from northwestern Minnesota, to teach our people. Like, to me, that's what it's about, right? We need to build a relationship, work together, because we're all in this together. This is our state. And I wanted to say, too, like, this is historic that I'm talking even today, right? Here I am, a Native American woman, Red Lake Nation band member, educated. I got my master's, right? I have my mother watching and my daughter on, who's in the master at the public school, School of Humphrey, which is big, right? The goal is education is the key out of these disparities. And I know there's stuff to talk about instant gratification. We're not victims. We're not this. No, we're survivors. We are Aboriginal people. The Native Americans were here in Minnesota. We are here since the 1700s. Like, it's crazy. And here we are, finally getting a chance, right? We're getting a chance to give hope to our community, hope to our people. And I don't believe we're going to be out taking money away from anybody, right? We're going to be keeping it here within the tribe, hiring our people. And the end of the day, it's going to save the state money because we're going to be uplifting our people, getting them off the social welfare rolls, right? Giving them that hope and getting a piece of this pie once and for all. But I'm really passionate about what I do, and I can't wait till you go on your bonding tour, and I hope that you guys stop and see us, right? Because we'll be able to go swimming in the lake. You guys can see who we are as Native people, because, I'm just really proud to be here today. And again, thank each and every one of you for listening to me last winter, Representative Murphy, of course, Dean Aldo, Erdahl, all of yous. So the building ain't nothing like what we presented last year because, of course, we had to redo it, downsize the original plans. But it's going to be a beautiful building, and it's going to be right on the lakeshore, the south end of Red Lake Nation. We'll be able to look at the water, you know, who we are as Native people, because that's who we are. Sorry, Representative Foley, I know I have to talk fast because it's down to the wire. And I'm sorry I don't have a PowerPoint, but we're always in crisis mode up here, always pushing And it's crazy. You guys don't even know the educated people I have as a tribal program. I lost count of how many masters, how many doctors, how many four-year degrees, how many two-year degrees we have. And that's hope. And that's what it's all about. So miigwech to each and every one of you.
Thank you, Ms. Goodwin, for sharing that too. And just want to emphasize again that, you know, we are on Native land. And today we having Dr. Goodwin and Dr. Stelly here to really come and present on this impact. You know, this goes back to discussions of, you know, how long have we been here? And, you know, we cannot, you know, forget our, you know, Black and brown brothers and sisters, you know, who were here because of the issues of slavery. And we cannot think that, you know, for the longest time that we have been as a state, that we have not made the investment for these communities to grow and really prosper. And so we are I am hopeful that this committee will do the work that we need to do for the entirety of the state of Minnesota. And so next Thursday, or this upcoming Thursday, we'll be hearing from different community groups and some of our institutions from the University of Minnesota to come and talk about what can equity and bonding look like. So with that, members, this meeting is adjourned.